President Bush speaks to the American people about Iraq, and the people speak back to Bush. This is a show about peace, preserving it, promoting it, and monitoring those who would seek to destroy it. I'm Verna Avery Brown. It was framed as a speech designed to educate the American people. From Cincinnati, the heartland of America, President-elect George Bush laid out his case for getting congressional authorization to attack Iraq, calling Saddam Hussein a murderous tyrant who poses an immediate threat to the American people. The president has convinced enough lawmakers. Congress is expected to pass a joint resolution by the end of the week, but polls show that public support is waning. Pacifica intern Laurel Paget-Seekins ventured onto the sidewalks of Washington, D.C. for public reaction to Bush's speech.
So did you listen to Bush's speech last night?
Yes, I did. And I thought it was a little bit sickening. We have a bad habit of creating monsters, you know, by funding them when it serves our purpose. And then when it turns around and bites us in the butt, we turn around and we decide that they're a public enemy or a public menace. You know, as a person that lost a child on September 11th, I've got a lot of resentment because there's been no honesty given out, you know, as far as what we do and how we do it. I just think it's sad because everyone's, you know, we've learned to capitalize off of other people's miseries. You know, I'm a Vietnam vet. I know how the system works. And I just think that we deserve a whole lot more honesty than what, you know, what we've been getting from Bush and from the rest of our so-called politicians.
Did you see Bush's speech last night?
Yeah, I saw Bush's speech last night. And I'm behind him 100%.
Did you learn anything new in the speech last night that you hadn't heard before?
I learned that Mr. Bush is a very patient man when it comes to dealing with people like Saddam Hussein. He should have been over there. He should have been knocked his ass out the box. These people don't care nothing about us. They want to kill us. They want to destroy us because they're jealous of America's prosperity. Anytime this country goes to war, we're not always right, but this is my country. This is where I was born at, and I support my president 100%, and I wish y'all quit coming to D.C., backing up all the traffic with all this marching and everything else, and look at things at the way they really are.
Did you watch Bush's speech last night?
No.
Can you tell me why not?
I was busy at work.
Did you watch Bush's speech last night?
I couldn't bear it. So what I did was I read it in the paper this morning.
Did you learn anything new from it?
No. I just learned once again that he's an idiot. How much more do I need to know?
Did you watch Bush's speech last night?
I did.
Did you learn anything new from it?
No, I found it pretty unconvincing.
Do you have any other opinion about what he's talking about?
I'm sorry I missed it. I think he ought to relate the situation he's in now to what it was like when Chamberlain went to visit Hitler in 1939. He went over to appease him, to try to talk him out of doing what he was doing. We know, we had an idea what he was trying to do. We didn't do anything, and look what happened.
The opinions of the public in the nation's capital. During his address last night, President Bush told those tuned into his speech that having the resolution would not mean that war was imminent or unavoidable, but it would show the United Nations that America speaks with one voice. During a roundtable discussion this morning, three experts on Iraq and Saddam Hussein deconstructed Bush's case. We spoke with Jacqueline Cabasso, executive director of the Western States Legal Foundation and co-author of The Shape of Things to Come, The Nuclear Posture Review, Missile Defense and the Dangers, and the Dangers of a New Arms Race.
A masterful work of propaganda that is just laced through with hypocrisy and doublespeak. What I was thinking about the fact that Bush is relying on historical things that Iraq has done to scare the American people, while at the same time very neatly severing any connection between the United States and those past actions. In other words, the fact that the United States was instrumental in supporting Saddam Hussein, providing biological agents and so on, that isn't in there. But what Iraq did in the past, which the United States takes issue with, is invoked as a current threat. And not one shred of evidence is actually provided to indicate that anything has substantively changed over the last few years. Now, if having weapons of mass destruction and a history of using them is a criteria, then without a doubt the United States poses the greatest threat to humanity that has ever existed. The new national security strategy doctrine of the United States, released in September, very specifically talks about preemptively removing attacks before the threats before they are fully formed. And the Nuclear Posture Review talks about using U.S. use of nuclear weapons in the event of surprising military developments, and it cites as an immediate contingency an Iraqi attack on Israel or its neighbors. And it's certainly easy enough to imagine that if pushed into a corner, Iraq may launch whatever it has, and we don't really know what it has, at Iraq, and that could essentially set off a regional conflagration of unimaginably horrific proportions. Israel, of course, has nuclear weapons. Many of the Arab countries in the region have chemical or biological weapons or precursors or their agents. So it's like the most grotesque example of throwing a match into a can of gasoline. It's an absolutely irresponsible and dangerous policy. It couldn't be more destabilizing. And I just want to mention that the original Security Council Resolution 687, which calls for Iraqi disarmament as part of a region-wide disarmament effort, and the United States has effectively blocked enforcement of that provision. The only way the tensions in the Middle East are going to be resolved is through regional negotiation and regional disarmament, including everybody.
Mm. But now, President Bush says, facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud. Anyone?
Well, I think that the mushroom cloud here is more likely to come from the United States, and I say that in all seriousness. The United States is currently developing nuclear weapons that are designed to penetrate into the earth before exploding. One of those weapons was conceived of after the Gulf War in order to get Saddam in his bunker, according to an early Department of Energy document. And so there are people in the administration who are just itching to use a nuclear weapon as the perhaps final demonstration of America's ultimate military and global supremacy.
Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun.
Also joining us in our discussion, Rahul Mahajan, author of The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism, and Ralph Shulman, co-host of WBAI's Taking Aim, and author of Iraq and Kuwait, The History Suppressed.
The fact is there is no clear danger. There has not been a shred of evidence produced to suggest that Iraq has the slightest intention or capability of targeting the United States in any way. And I think that's really important to focus on. If the claim is that any country that has any kind of weapon is potentially a threat, then the United States has license to attack anybody in the world. Iraq is different from most other countries in that it has used chemical weapons during the Iran-Iraq war, both against the Iranian army and against Kurds in Iraq. But it did that very much completely under the umbrella of the United States, with the full aid and backing of the United States, and that hardly constitutes evidence that Iraq is targeting the United States in any way. So it's not just that there's no clear and present danger. There's not the slightest indication of a threat.
I would say, furthermore, that we have to be very specific about this. The charge that the Iranians used cyanide gas on the Kurds at Halabja has been proven to be a contrivance, a fraudulent accusation. Stephen Pelletier of the Defense Intelligence Agency and the American War College published a 90-page report disclosing Defense Intelligence Agency documents which showed that, as it happens, the mustard gas which the U.S. military had given to the Iraqis had been used on Iranian troops, and the Iranians retaliated in Halabja with the cyanide gas that resulted in the death of the Kurds. That specific crime against the Kurdish population in Halabja happened to come from the weapons that were deployed by the Iranians and, by the way, supplied by the Israelis, for the record.
Well, that's a highly questionable claim, and it's part and the claim that Iran was involved in the chemical weapons attacks on Halabja was part of a United States pattern of covering up for Iraq at the time, and the Army War College was very much part of trying to paper over any Iraqi atrocities. The point is not that it's a fabrication, but rather that it's really irrelevant to talk about war.
Well, Rahul, I think
these claims by Pelletier have been debunked numerous times by now.
I have to take issue with that, but I would rather than dispute about the Pelletier report, which has been amply substantiated, we need to. I agree with your basic point, which I share, that all of this is a contrivance. And one of the evidences of this was the Glasgow Sunday Herald report on September 22nd, that the two figures who have been designated by the Central Intelligence Agency and the United States rulers to replace the regime of Saddam Hussein are General Nizar al-Khazraji, the Iraqi field commander who was deploying chemical weapons against the Shia and Kurdish population and against the Iranians. And the second Iraqi leader designated by the U.S. to replace the regime is General Najib al-Salehi, commander of the armored divisions of the Iraqi Republican Guard, who led the incursion into Kuwait that was solicited and contrived by the U.S., we should state, but who also caused 1.5 million people to flee in the crushing of the Shia population in the south, which he acknowledged in his book Al-Zilzal, The Earthquake. He heads the CIA's Iraqi Free Officers Movement. Nothing so illustrates the total dishonesty and hypocrisy of U.S. rulers who have always deployed these comprador client generals to suppress their own population and to serve the interests of U.S. imperialism in the region. That is really what points to the hypocrisy of citing the weapons supplied by the U.S. and deploying the replacement figures who are the agents of this very destruction of which they then complain. And it really, I think, illustrates the fact that what motivates the U.S. here is the seizure of the 220 billion barrels of oil and oil reserves in Iraq.
America believes that all people are entitled to hope and human rights, to the non-negotiable demands of human dignity. People everywhere prefer freedom to slavery, prosperity to squalor, self-government to the rule of terror and torture. America is a friend to the people of Iraq.
Which I thought was a little odd considering he's planning to attack the people of Iraq. I was wondering how that set with the rest of you.
Well, that was the final, you know, that was the final indication that he wants to go to war, because every time the United States goes to war, you know, the Gulf War wasn't an attack on the Iraqi people. We didn't want to attack the Serbian people. We didn't want to attack the Afghan people. In each case, I think the Iraqs, the Serbs, and the Afghans knew better and, in fact, in many cases, fled from our policy of non-attack of them. It shows the incredible hypocrisy and essentially the cynical belief that they can say anything, no matter how ludicrous, and get away with it.
Yes, I agree with that. And look, the Los Angeles Times, February 25th, 1991. Fuel air explosives, the deadliest non-nuclear bombs in the Allied arsenal, disperse a highly volatile mist over a large area. The cloud is ignited, a second explosion occurs, the resulting blast packs the wallop of a nuclear device. The bombs suck up oxygen, pulling the lungs and organs out of the victims' bodies. Another advantage is that the force of a conventional explosion decreases rapidly as one moves away from the center of the blast, but the concussion of the fuel-air devices is evenly distributed. And it goes on to describe the incendiary gel, which is an improved form of napalm, which has been used throughout in the bombing of Iraq during the Gulf War. They are contemplating 1,200 sorties a day of B-1 bombers, the saturation bombing using fiendish weapons that are implosion devices that suck all the oxygen out of the air, pulling the lungs and the organs out of the victims' bodies, hundreds of thousands of casualties, the devastation of the civilian population, the infrastructure of Iraq, the weapons of mass destruction, the genocidal program of this war. We contemplate it, we discuss it in a certain antiseptic fashion. Nothing can quite convey the horror of what is going to take place. And the bombings are taking place, and the attack on Iraq has been going on now since March. As DEBCA, the Israeli Intelligence Service, has been documenting, every day they are bombing in Iraq, and there are special forces in place. The war is on. Mm. It's only a question of when they gain sanction for the total devastation that they have been preparing for some time.
Saying that the United States is a friend to the Iraqi people is just one of so many lies that were put out last night that we could be on this call all day debunking them. This is the big lie. And people really need to realize now what we are up against. We are up against a force, and I'm talking about the Bush administration, that is so arrogant, that is so drunk on power and right-wing ideology, that the Bush administration undoubtedly presents a very grave danger to international peace and security. And we have to keep our eye on that. You could almost read this speech and substitute Bush or American regime every time he talks about Saddam or Iraqi regime. We are in really serious trouble here. This is a big lie.
There was one thing that we learned from the speech very clearly, all right, and that was when Bush said he tried to intimate that war may not be inevitable. What that means is not that he has changed his plans, but that he's making a tactical retreat and is once again essentially trying to play the PR game by making it look as if the United States will be forced into war. So the plan has become pretty clear. The plan, outlined in the draft UN resolution that the United States is pushing, is essentially to make the resumption of inspections a roving military occupation, which is to say that inspectors are to be accompanied by security forces, that they're able to go anywhere at any time with any amount of personnel, that they're able to essentially block off roads and land and air passages between different places when they do their inspections, essentially to say that the United States can impose an indefinite roving military occupation on Iraq and that any violation of that occupation would then be grounds for war. This is exactly what the United States did to generate a casus belli against Serbia in 1999 with the Rambouillet draft accords. This is exactly what the United States did last year against Afghanistan, where there it was a roving military occupation to essentially liquidate terrorist training camps and the so-called support network of the terrorists. In each case, you pitch demands so high, an indefinite military occupation which totally destroys the sovereignty of a nation, that no sovereign nation will accede to those demands, and then when they refuse to accede, you say, well, this justifies war. And that, I think, is the game plan coming up right now.
But, Raul, the president says that he needs to have this resolution so that the UN will understand that the American people speak with one voice.
Obviously, the American people, if they are speaking very clearly, the one voice is saying, we don't want war. I mean, congressmen are reporting that they get 10 anti-war calls or letters to every pro-war call or letter.
Yes, but the Congress isn't. The Congress is likely to pass the resolution.
That's right. They're simply completely ignoring the voice of their constituents. This has been a real test of democracy and foreign policy here, and Congress is failing in a major way. They are not listening to their representatives, and they're not listening to the voice of the people.
Rahul Mahajan, author of The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism, and Ralph Schulman, co-host of WBAI's Taking Aim and author of Iraq and Kuwait, The History Suppressed. We were also joined in that roundtable by Jacqueline Cabasso, executive director of the Western States Legal Foundation. We'll be back in a minute.
Missiles flying in the third world towards the people stranded on their knees. Bombs falling over Baghdad, killing children who are starving by degrees. There are those of us who'd question What's the goal and what's the cost? 600,000 dead malnourished children, a UN-sanctioned Holocaust. Missiles flying in the third world, from Hanoi to Wounded Knee. Bombs falling over Baghdad, and each one shouts, democracy. Contras, kings and generals, brandish stars and stripes. From Rangoon to Los Angeles, selling oil, guns and crack pipes. Missiles flying in the third world, and each one will kill a child. Bombs falling over Baghdad, and hunger and death is running wild. We had to destroy the village in order to save it, to help this jungle crawl. First we had to pave it.
The Republican majority in the House of Representatives and most Democrats are poised to pass the president's resolution in support of using force in Iraq, but a vocal minority took to the House floor today to argue against the bill. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Josh Chafin reports from Capitol Hill.
Most Democrats in the House debate today said they'd rather be talking about the economy, about failing schools, or about corporate scandal. Some even said they're concerned the U.S. hasn't fulfilled its obligations in Afghanistan. But in spite of lukewarm popular support, most Democrats say they'll vote in favor of the president's resolution for use of force on Iraq. A handful came out against the resolution today, among them the Democrat from Ohio, Dennis Kucinich, who for months has been saying the White House created the crisis with Iraq. Kucinich used his time today to put the resolution into an international context.
The resolution presented to Congress by the administration gives authority to the president to act prior to and even without a UN resolution. And it authorizes the president to use U.S. troops to enforce UN resolutions even without United Nations request for it. In other words, America would be going it alone. This is a violation, this resolution, of Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which reserves the ability to authorize force for that purpose to the UN Security Council alone. At the beginning of this new century, our prayer should be for a world united by international law, for a world as an interconnected whole. No nation should be above international law. All nations must confirm international law. All nations should seek to bring back into the international community any nation which sets itself apart. Let our concerns about weapons of mass destruction cause America to lead the way toward destruction of all weapons of mass destruction anywhere and everywhere in the world. There are 17 nations nuclear, 20 nations that have biological weapons capability or seeking them, 26 nations that have chemical weapons capability or are seeking those capabilities, 16 nations that have missile capabilities are seeking them. Are we to suddenly declare war on the world?
Ohio Democratic Congressman Dennis Kucinich. Like Kucinich, Republican Ron Paul has been a vocal opponent of the use of force against Iraq. He says his constituents in rural Texas aren't worried about Saddam Hussein. They're worried about their jobs. Today, Paul spoke of what he called a Christian doctrine he uses to justify going to war.
And I think this effort and this plan to go to war comes up short of that doctrine. First, it says that there has to be an act of aggression, and there has not been an act of aggression against the United States. We're 6,000 miles from our shore. Also, it says that all efforts at negotiations must be exhausted. I don't believe that is the case. It seems to me like the opposition, the enemy right now, is begging for more negotiations. And also, it says that the Christian doctrine says that the proper authority must be responsible for initiating the war. And I do not believe that proper authority can be transferred to the president nor to the United Nations.
One of Ron Paul's Republican colleagues used his time this morning to criticize those who would consort with the enemy, a reference to a Democratic congressional mission which came back from Iraq last week. One member of that mission, David Bonnier of Michigan, blamed the U.S. for causing what he called a humanitarian crisis in Iraq with sanctions and uranium dust that's left over from the first Gulf War. Bonnier also spoke of the precedent that a new war would set.
I am not ready to alter the course that we have taken since our founding, to embrace the preemptive strike doctrine. If we strike first, what kind of message does that send to the tinderboxes of Pakistan and India, China and Taiwan, North and South Korea? Are we prepared to strike first in Iran, in North Korea? Where does it end? The broader global implications will be grave. Second, I am not ready to act unilaterally and in potential defiance of the United Nations Security Council, because by going it alone, what signal do we issue by tossing aside diplomacy? What sirens do we set off by ignoring the rest of the world? The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, destructive means cannot bring about constructive ends. And yet here we are, thrown headlong into a decision that could cost thousands and thousands of American men and women their lives, could put our personnel and embassies all over the globe in harm's way, in danger, could unleash another round, another decade of untold suffering among innocent Iraqis. And we are told that we have no other choice.
Democrat David Bonnier of Michigan. Here's California Democrat Barbara Lee.
How does all of this make the American people safer? Are our airports safer today? Are our seaports secure? What happens to the economic security of our country and our unmet domestic needs, given the enormous amount of money, upwards of $100 to $200 billion, that this war will cost us? And how many of our brave young men and women will be put in harm's way? Going to war would result in substantial loss of life. We'd better be able to answer these questions before we spend $200 billion plus to create a new regime in Iraq. Now remember, and we all have to focus on the fact that it was not weapons of mass destruction used on 9/11. So this blank check to authorize a first strike will not restore peace and security. I'm convinced that it will inspire hatred and fear and increase instability and insecurity.
Congresswoman Barbara Lee will introduce a competing amendment to the resolution for use of force on Iraq tomorrow. A proposal by Democrat John Spratt of South Carolina would ask the White House to wait for a vote in the UN Security Council. Most Democrats look poised to vote with the Republican majority in the House. The vote could come as soon as tomorrow. The Senate could start debate on its version of the resolution to use force on Iraq this week as well. Josh Chaffin on Capitol Hill for Pacifica's Peace Watch.
Imperatives for Peace. After the break, a recipe for activism, Maxine Waters, and more.